This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hello, once again, you are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us. As you know, we alternate weeks with Dr. Hal Schertz. He's on when I am not here, but you are lucky enough because it's my turn this week. So thank you very much for spending some time with The Doctor's Lounge. This is the show where you come to listen to what doctors are talking about in doctors' lounges all across the country. The breakfast buffets are open, the coffee is hot, and as usual, docs have a lot to talk about. One of the things that docs are talking about, at least in my specialty, ear, nose, and throat, this particular time of year is, of course, the allergies. And in the southeast here in the Atlanta area, pollen counts are rising like crazy. The tree count this morning is well above 2,000, and that makes us very busy in the office talking to patients and helping folks with all of their sinus and nasal symptoms. And as it turns out, America's Web Radio is pretty busy, too. And I'm proud to repeat from David that March has been one of the busiest months, if not the busiest month, measured as website visits for America's Web Radio in its history. So congratulations to the network for that nice statistic. And I'm proud and privileged to say that the Docs Lounge is a part of that. Last month we had almost, we're just a few podcasts short of 14,000 podcast downloads in 1 month during the month of March, and that represents a threefold increase, a tripling of our podcast volume compared to our average for the last 6 months of 2014 when we were just getting started. So it looks like things are going our way, and we're very happy and very grateful and privileged to be on this network, and we're very happy for your interest and your willingness to continue to listen to us and keep us going. So we will start with some local Atlanta news, and although it's local news, it's actually gotten a lot of national attention. It's been in the news off and on for several years, I think going back to 2009, and it has to do with the scandal in Atlanta public schools regarding the alleged, I guess now we can say it happened since they were convicted yesterday, which is the big news, that the verdicts were read by the jury for 12 Atlanta public school teachers who were changing standardized test scores, trying to game the system in the No Child Left Behind program, which incentivizes teachers and schools based on standardized test scores. So it was apparently a very dramatic scene in the courtroom because as the verdicts were read and 11 out of 12 of these teacher defendants were convicted, that they were immediately incarcerated. This wasn't a situation where they were sent to jail and they're going to await sentencing and then begin their jail time, in an elective fashion, where they would report at some later date. They were immediately put on a bus and sent straight to prison. And a lot of folks thought this was a bit much. And they said, well, these are teachers for crying out loud, and all they did was erase a few lead pencil marks and color them in somewhere else. You know, is this something that we send educators directly to jail for with no obvious advance warning? And some people thought this was a rather, dramatic move on the part of the judge. And I promise I'm going to connect this back to healthcare, so I'm not just going off half-cocked here. There is a reason I'm bringing this up. The presumed ringleader of these folks, Superintendent Beverly Hall, unfortunately passed away of breast cancer a few months ago, so she was not able to stand trial on her own. But apparently, allegedly, she was the ringleader of a culture of, quote, fear, intimidation, and retaliation. Teachers who tried to report what was going on over the past several years were threatened into losing their jobs, into having ethics investigations conducted against them for being whistleblowers, and even having their mental health questioned if they tried to bring to the attention of outsiders or someone who was supposed to help out that there was cheating going on. In fact, in the shadow of this, Ms. Hall was named the Superintendent of the Year in 2009, right before this story broke, and apparently the basis of that award was, at least in part, the rising, now we know fraudulent, standardized test scores of elementary school and secondary school students. So in Atlanta, and I think even across the country, this is a rather dramatic story to see this level of punishment, at least on the front end, as they await sentencing. But there's a reason that this comes to my attention, and the reason why this is worthy material for the Doctor's Lounge. So here's the question, David. Now I'm going to put David on the spot. He does not have any advance notice of the question. But where, my friend, have we heard this before? Where else, and the clue here it is within the healthcare system, have we heard of a large government entity, right, like the Atlanta Public Schools, right? Students in the Atlanta Public Schools have there's no competition for their business, no freedom of choice, no ability to go around the public school system. But where in our government healthcare system have we heard of an entity that has no competition, where the patients really have no freedom of choice to go somewhere else? And because of the lack of competition, you have to enforce performance through some arbitrary, artificial pay-for-performance standards. There are bonuses based on these standards, and because of that culture of artificial, meaningless benchmarks, you get gaming of the system, you get falsified records, you get institutionalized cheating and corruption, and just like in the Atlanta Public School thing, you get this culture of fear and intimidation that if someone tries to come in and say, hey, what are you guys doing here? This is not ethically right. You are threatened, you are transferred, you are suspended. Where, David, I'm guessing by the look on his face, he knows the answer. Go ahead.
Well, Doctor, obviously it has something to do with our folks that have served the country well, and they expect to get service, and they're put on waiting lists. The people that are in charge at the VA get bonuses for lying, and you have forced me now to go into something else.
Okay.
I mentioned to you before the show that we were doing some things. Michael Conley, that does our Constitution, and the U.S. Justice Foundation, along with America's Web Radio, we have filed a Freedom of Information Act with Homeland Security, the DOJ, and Veterans Administration, and the VA, with regard to what they have done to our, or not done for our soldiers and our veterans. And they came back, it was just incredible, the garbage that they initially sent back. So we went back to them and said, you know, the next step is appeal, and we are in the process. I say we are. Michael Conley is in the process of doing this. The biggest, and that's as far as I'll go with what we're doing with the VA and the lawsuits that we're going to be filing. But I would like to add one other thing. The word that you mentioned that connects it all, and I'm getting sick and damn tired of it, but it connects everything that you said, whether it's Atlanta school system, the VA, anything connects back to one word, money. And you mentioned they were getting bonuses at the VA for poor performance and lying, cheating. It's stealing as far as I'm concerned. You go back to the Atlanta situation. One thing, money. They were getting bonuses for upping the, making it look like that the school system was doing better when, in fact, yeah, they were doing better overnight with an eraser. So, well, this is a shame. The society that we live in is based on one thing, money.
Well, and the other problem is that, you know, all of this is based on arbitrary standards, right? In a true free market economy, it is the customer who should have a chance to choose with whom they do business. And the fundamental problem is, you know, there's nothing evil about money per se, I don't think. There's nothing evil about profits per se, and there's nothing evil about people acting in a manner of self-preservation and self-promotion. That is the essence of all of us as human beings, I think. The problem is when you create artificial incentives, when you take away the customer's right, whether it's the parents of a child where that child is pretty much stuck in public school unless you're one of the few who can pay twice for school, right, once through your property taxes and once through, you know, paying very highly priced private school tuitions with no voucher system in place, you don't have the freedom to choose. You know, if there was, if the public schools, if Atlanta Public Schools could had to compete with other schools, there was no Child Left Behind standardized test-driven incentives, then everything would seek its own level. And if the APC wasn't doing a good job or any public school wasn't doing a good job, then you could send your kids elsewhere. And then they would be faced with dwindling enrollment numbers that would give them an opportunity to fire the weaker teachers and clean things up and do a little introspection just based on the fact that, you know, in August the classrooms are a lot emptier than they were the year before. I mean, that's what private schools have to do. I mean, you know, every year, you know, both my kids go to private school and, you know, they're special needs kids, but I'm given the choice every year when they send me the statement. I can either re-up for another year, or I am free to choose not to. So there's no arbitrary, you know, measurement system in place for the Atlanta Public Schools. But, you know, in both cases, the corruption goes all the way back. I mean, you know, we're not going to rehash the VA thing, you know, totally, because we've done that in shows past from last year. But to briefly review a history, I mean, the corruption in the VA goes all the way back to its creation when it was created as the Veterans Bureau in 1921, shortly after World War I. But apparently, if you, you know, accept the historical accounts at face value, the corruption began before the ink was even dry on the founding documents.
Why
and
have,
n- nine years later,
corruption?
What?
Why do you have corruption?
Well, you have corruption when there's no free market to keep people honest, right? You can't fake out the customer in a free market economy. The customer is going to have a level of service, either a product or a service or a combination of both, and they're going to make judgments based on their experience. And it is very difficult to fool the customer in that setting. And we're going to go on today in the show and establish the argument that the same thing applies in healthcare. That you, if you have a third-party payment system, and we're going to review a book in the later segments called Catastrophic Care, why everything we think we know in healthcare is wrong, by David Goldhill, an author that I had the privilege of meeting in Washington, D.C., along with the rest of the Docs for Patient Care board last week. But we're going to get there. But you have this problem where you create a government entity, whether it's public schools or VA, you have no competition, performance is poor, you get these quality guidelines, which then, you know, are begging to be gamed. I mean, they're begging to be arbitrarily manipulated so that people get their performance bonuses. And the longer this goes on, in the case of the Atlanta Public Schools and the VA, the more institutionalized it gets, the more bold and the more fearless the perpetrators become. And then it begins to survive on its own. It reaches a critical mass. And then anybody trying to come in to say, hey, this is wrong, you know, they can't do anything. They're suspended, they're fired, they're pushed along, and, you know, it survives on its own until a cataclysmic event, whether it's the exposure of corruption at the VA last year or this Atlanta Public School trial. You know, the bottom line is you can repeat this experiment 100 times and get exactly the same result, which is you're going to get gaming and you're going to get corruption because the incentives beg for it. It is not a matter of human beings being inherently evil. It is a matter of understanding the inherent behavior of human beings to act in a manner of self-preservation. I mean, consider the plight of the Atlanta school teachers. Their fate, their jobs were on the line based on how a bunch of elementary school kids perform on a test. I mean, talk about having your fate out of your control, your fate out of your hands. I mean, you teach these kids as best you can, and yet you're told by your principal and your superintendent that if your kids' standardized scores don't meet a certain level or don't improve by a certain amount, that your job is in jeopardy and your livelihood is in jeopardy. You know, I would submit that these folks almost didn't have a choice. You know, then you're lying awake in bed at night wondering how an 8-year-old is going to perform on a test, and your fate, your ability to pay the rent and buy groceries is based on how this 8-year-old performs. That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. We are at the end of the first segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is Dr. George. Join me on Wednesday mornings from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock when we talk about more than medicine. It's now about staying healthy, but it's about the strategy to do so. Join me on Medicine on Call.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for spending time with us. We're into the second segment now, and we're going to continue our conversation about how the recent Atlanta Public School cheating scandal, where convictions were handed down yesterday for 11 out of 12 defendants, has a lot to do with the VA scandal, where there is no competition. There's no, you know, the customers have no other choices as to where they get their services, and of course that creates a culture of corruption and poor performance. We've gone through the argument, but here's the scary part. We talked about you can't have a system where, you know, patients are not customers, where patients are not consumers, and you have this separation because of a third-party payer. And if that third-party payer is the government, that separation is even greater. But here's the scary part. We are about to do that crazy experiment one more time. We're about to force doctors into an even worse situation with artificial pay-for-performance parameters. And this goes back to the SGR bill. All right, this goes back to the bill that was just passed by the House last Thursday. When we were in Washington, D.C., it was passed early in the morning, and we were making a couple of visits to the Hill that afternoon. But this bill is nicely summarized by John Graham, or at least nicely discussed by John Graham in a recent online Forbes opinion piece. Remember, this SGR bill has been hailed by organized medicine at all levels, virtually across all specialties, AMA, American College of Surgeons, our specialty society, American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, and virtually all specialty societies and forms of organized medicine have hailed this bill as a victory, as finally the legislature doing something that is good for everybody by getting rid of this sustained growth rate formula and replacing it with something that is a bit more predictable. And that piece is true as far as it goes, but what nobody really knows about this bill, obviously organized medicine did not know or understand about this bill, is that this bill's 263 pages. Right, I pulled the original document last night to have a look at it. 263 pages. The first 5 pages repeal the sustained growth rate formula. The remaining 250 plus pages do a host of other things completely unrelated to repealing SGR, and it really makes the bill a giant Trojan horse. A giant Trojan horse that sneaks in Obamacare stuff, quite frankly. This bill was negotiated by, you know, secret negotiations behind closed doors. There was really no opportunity to review and comment on this bill prior to its passage through the House. And in fact, there was a magician-type distraction going on. Publicly, all the conversation was about the budget that the House was creating. But while, you know, the news cycle was concentrated on that, behind closed doors, this SGR thing was getting worked out. And we really didn't know much about it. We weren't able to get our hands on it until it was passed. Now, you know, Dr. Howe, Dr. Schertz last week sort of reviewed all of this in very nice detail, so I'm not going to repeat that in its entirety, but just to summarize a couple of highlights. This thing is really Obamacare light. This is really a lot of things in Obamacare's vision for Medicare is enacted in this bill. And so we see a lot of the things that are common to the VA and the Atlanta Public Schools in terms of arbitrary, meaningless pay-for-performance standards becoming institutionalized, becoming locked into this bill. This rolls up, you know, three ridiculous programs. Number one, the Meaningful Use Program, which we've covered at length as a bad thing. The PQRS Quality Reporting Program, which we haven't talked about at length, but I will tell you, not only as a physician, but as a computer programmer that has to program this stuff into our EMR for compliance, that it is a royal pain in the rear that adds nothing to quality of care, and locks in something called the value-based modifier system into a single composite quality score for every physician. And your Medicare pay, the amount that you get paid by Medicare, not reimbursed, that's the wrong word. It's a price. We're getting paid for legitimate services, not a reimbursement. What Medicare will pay us physicians is going to be dependent on our composite score based on our compliance with these three programs. And that's going to put us in a position very similar to the Atlanta teachers, who didn't have much choice as to what to do, and the VA culture, where if you objected to what was going on, you still don't have any choice regarding how to behave. We're going to have the same thing going on. You say, well, that's ridiculous, Dr. K. That doesn't make any sense. The doctor, you know, you're in your own practice. You have a freedom of choice. You can do these things or you cannot do them. Well, that's possibly true as far as it goes, but consider this. The proportion of physicians who are becoming employed is going up and up and up as a result of Obamacare and the changing climate. There is a huge move to consolidate, and doctors' practices are being bought by hospitals in herds and droves. So what happens in that situation? The doctor is no longer free to practice medicine the way he or she wishes to practice. Now you're on salary with some sort of productivity bonus, but the entity that hires you, the hospital, let's say, is still responsible for collecting money from Medicare and Medicaid. So what are they going to do? They're going to put pressure on their employed physicians to, in fact, it's more than pressure, it's probably a requirement, that their employed physicians comply with the PQRS, the Meaningful Use, and the Value-Based Modifier programs so that their composite scores are adequate to get the best bonus that they can. And what do you suppose is going to happen when this is institutionalized for long enough? You're going to get the same thing. It's Atlanta Public Schools all over again. It's the VA all over again. You're going to get pressure for docs to game the system. The institution will be gaming the system so that they can get what they want, because it's all about, you know, as David said in the last segment, it is all about the money. And when you have an incentive system that has nothing to do with patients making a choice as to where they want to get their care, this is what's going to happen. It's running the same experiment all over again. And so we have a failure of organized medicine to support rank and file physicians because of their financial relationship with the government over these quality guidelines. And this is the part that I didn't know until lately, part of this thing that was passed in the SGR fix, and it's been around for a while, is that the government, CMS, is paying the specialty societies, and therefore the physicians and administrators who staff the administrative structure of these specialty societies, they are getting paid by the government to develop quality guidelines for their specialty. Now you say, what's wrong with that? Right? We would certainly rather have our own docs in leadership positions coming up with these guidelines than some bureaucrat inside the Beltway. And that piece is true. I mean, if those are my only two choices, to have quality guidelines done by a bureaucrat in Washington versus quality guidelines done by a ear, nose, and throat specialist who understands how I practice, yeah, I would choose the latter. But the problem is there's another choice, which is to not to have the quality guidelines at all. What happens in this situation is we now have a financial relationship between organized medicine and CMS. And what does that do? Well, the first thing it does is divide and conquer. divide and conquer. Now you have the upper echelons of organized medicine on the take, getting money from the government to do the government's bidding. And in that situation, again, it's not because humans are evil. It's not because these people that staff and run the specialty societies are bad people. Far from it. They're very dedicated, and they do a whole lot of work that they don't get paid for. No question about it. But if you put them in an incentive system, in a financial microenvironment that rewards them for making a deal with the devil, guess what they're going to do? You know, they're going to do it. If I was in that situation, I would do it, because it is about self-preservation and self-advancement. There's nothing intrinsically evil about that. The problem is the environment that you put folks in. So we have a divide and conquer. We have now splintered the specialty society's leadership, organized medicine's leadership, away from the grassroots physicians and taken them into the fold of government, of CMS. The second thing that it has done is that it has institutionalized quality measures. Now our physician leadership comes down to us, the grassroots docs, and says, these are quality measures. These are good. The public demands that. That's not true. You know, this is all very good, and we're working with the government to make this happen, and isn't it good that we're doing it instead of having it forced on us from without? And now, you know, we have a divide and conquer, and we have a situation where now quality care is institutionalized and endorsed by organized medicine, by our leadership, both in general and within virtually all of the medical and surgical specialties. So John Graham's article in Forbes magazine a couple of days ago gives a pair of quotes. So the first pair is from Representative Paul Ryan supporting SGR, the bill. Paul Ryan's coming out in support of this SGR doc fix bill that was just passed. And President Obama making a speech on the fifth anniversary of Obamacare, which was just a few days ago. And it turns out that you can't tell one speech from the other, and this was Mr. Graham's point, is if you look at the paragraph from Representative Ryan and you look at the paragraph from Barack Obama, you cannot tell one from the other. And that was actually a great way that John Graham put it, is here's two quotes. I'm not going to tell you who said what. See if you can figure it out. And then he gives you the answer at the bottom of the article. But the point is clear, and it's valid, which is you can't tell the difference. Clearly, the SGR bill, the doc fix bill, you know, has inside the belly of the Trojan horse Obamacare. And so it becomes an incremental victory for Obamacare, a failure, in my opinion, of the House GOP and organized medicine, and it's all done with this Trojan horse of the SGR. Everybody was so pumped up after 12 years and 17 crises, manufactured crises, over Medicare payments. Everyone was so pumped and so excited to make all that go away that they didn't bother to read the rest of the bill. And guess what? You really didn't have a chance to read the rest of the bill anyway. So it was a very clever, manipulative tool to get another incremental victory for Obamacare and lock down all these quality measures, meaningful use, PQRS, all of this stuff, and make it even harder to overcome this and institutionalize even further the idea that we docs are going to be spending all of our time jumping through hoops, meeting arbitrary quality measures that don't mean a darn thing in terms of real quality of care, and making the practice of medicine even worse, almost impossible. So that's the bad news. There is some good news in the pike that we will talk about at the beginning of the next segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay with us. That's an order.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today and sticking around for the second half of the show. We've got some real good stuff coming up, so don't go away. The first two segments of the show, we're kind of talking about bad news, right? It was all kind of downer stuff. We're talking about Atlanta Public School scandal, VA scandal, and how this SGR bill looks good and people are emotionally pumped up about it because it solves a 12-year-old problem regarding Medicare payments and takes a lot of stress and a lot of uncertainty out of the Medicare payment system. But I would submit to you that we have we've taken a step backwards rather than a step forwards because we have sacrificed our ability to fight Obamacare in return for some certainty regarding Medicare payments. And as we discussed in the last segment, that is not a good thing. As counterintuitive as that might seem, I think we actually lost ground with this bill rather than gained ground because of what we had to put in there to reach consensus in the legislature. So that's the bad news. The good news is that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation is on the move. There are good things happening with our organization, and I am pleased to report that our president, Dr. Lee Gross, who's a primary care physician in Florida and founder of Epiphany Health, which is a direct-to-primary care practice, is making great strides in getting some legislation passed in Florida to legally solidify the ability of direct-to-primary care systems to function. So brief review, and we've talked about this on the show before, and Hal has had Dr. Gross as a guest before, so I'm not going to go into deep details, but just to review some highlights, is what is the direct-to-primary care model? Well, in short, it's a way for you to get routine health care from a primary care physician with no insurer involved. Right, you pay a regular fee, and for an individual, it's cheap. It's $50 a month for an individual, $135 a month, I think, for a family of four, directly to the physician. There's no insurance middleman. There's no bunch of administrators in the middle. There's nobody skimming money off the top just to fly at sit at a desk and push papers around. And as a result, you save a huge amount of money. Now, admittedly, you have to get what they call wraparound insurance. You need insurance for cancer and car accidents and rare catastrophic stuff, but that really puts the role of insurance in a true insurance role. It makes insurance what it's supposed to be, which is management of risk, and makes insurance not be what it's not supposed to be, which is a benefits program, merely a payment mechanism for routine expenses. So that's the good part. Now, you know, the potential weakness of something like this is that a state insurance board might be tempted to regard a direct for primary care practice as insurance and say, no, the doc, the practice is taking risk, right? You're taking a fixed amount of money in and then you're promising to provide care, you know, whatever the circumstances up to a certain point. That represents risk. Therefore, you're an insurance company. Therefore, you're out of business unless you do all the things insurance company does. Well, Dr. Gross is making some great strides, and he shared a story with us about his adventures in the Florida legislature in the committee, in their, I think they call it their Health and Energy Committee. I forget the name of the committee, but it was the committee that was reviewing this bill in the state of Florida. And I decided just to record this, and I'm hoping that this will play, and I hope that it's something. But here's the conversation from the Florida legislatures regarding this direct-to-primary care bill. It's a bill that makes this completely legal, gets all the legal ambiguity out of the equation. So here we go.
I wanted to debate it because I wanted to say this is literally, I think, one of the better pieces of legislation not only have I seen this session, but that I've seen since I've been up in Tallahassee. You know, we've been hearing on the healthcare debate, you know, for the last several years that, you know, the government should get out of the way between the doctor and the patient. But we haven't heard that with the insurance company. And to be quite honest, I couldn't think of a better piece of legislation that could help low-income residents of the state of Florida to have a direct relationship with their doctor, to not have to deal with an insurance company who for them might be burdensome and cumbersome and too sophisticated of a process, to where they can pick their doctor, they can sign a simple contract, they could know what services they're going to receive, they could pay a minimal fee to get those services. And to be honest, while obviously, you know, this is a first start, this is something that we could come back in a year or so and provide incentives to doctors to offer. It could be something that we provide stipends for people who are well above the poverty line so that they can see these doctors. This is an idea that really could mature as it goes. And in the spirit of time, I'll conclude my comments. But this is really excellent work, Representative.
Further debate? Representative Rogers in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saw this piece of legislation in my Health Innovations Committee and supported it then. But I just want to make it very clear, it does not only help low income or those that are struggling. There is a model that rich and eloquent and those folks that can afford it does pay directly to their doctors. It's just another model, another tool, so that others can also participate without insurance companies getting into it as that third party that creates a higher cost to persons who want to participate. So it's a good bill, and I support it, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Further debate.
So what did you just hear? You heard two legislatures talking about this bill that I am told are Democrats. Therefore, I presume, I don't know for sure, presume are Obamacare supporters who are recognizing that the direct-to-primary care model is a way to reach the uninsured. It is a way to reach low-income folks as well as medium and high-income folks. I think they recognize that across the income spectrum that this was a great idea, and this is coming from Democrats. And they were talking about upping the ante even farther. They're saying, let's revisit this again in a couple of years, and let's make this program even stronger. Let's provide incentives to primary care physicians to open direct-to-primary care practices. Let's offer stipends to low and to low income folks to be able to afford this kind of thing, and you know, let's they recognize that a third party brings a higher cost to healthcare. That when you involve an insurer, that when you involve a third party between the doctor and the patient, that is messing with the financial issues and disturbing the free market, free choice model, that that's a bad thing. So this is huge, and this is coming from Democrats. I mean, this is I was shocked pleasantly to hear this. So, you know, apparently this bill was sent to committee by the insurance lobby in Florida to try and kill it, to try to get a bunch of debate going, I think based on the notion that if you move people into a direct-to-primary care model and out of full-coverage insurance, that this is going to, you know, lower tax revenues. I think that was the argument. And nobody bought it. The committee voted 17 to nothing unanimously to allow, I think, the bill to go to the general legislature for a vote. So, you know, a huge victory for Dr. Gross, our foundation president. I am told by him that today he has an opportunity to put this in front of the Senate at some level. And so things are moving along, you know, not only in Florida, but, you know, the support that this is getting, the widespread bipartisan support this is getting, suggests that maybe – just maybe there is a movement growing out there, maybe starting from the fringes and working in, that recognizes that government is not a part of the solution, it's a part of the problem. That insurers, in their current full coverage mode, are not a part of the solution, but a part of the problem. And that health insurance needs to downsize a little bit. And that what we really need to make healthcare work well is kind of a I don't want to use the term two-tiered, that's too politically charged, but a two-part system that allows routine stuff to be paid for directly by the patient and allows catastrophic, you know, God forbid type events like car accidents and cancer and chronic disease that's expensive to come under some sort of insurance coverage. And that would make insurance for health the same as life insurance, car insurance, homeowners insurance, where insurance is there truly for insurance purposes, which is to mitigate risk for rare and catastrophic events, right? You have car insurance in the event that your car gets wrecked. You don't have car insurance to pay for oil changes and, you know, lube jobs and shocks and brakes and all that stuff that every car we know will need, right? That's not what insurance is for. It shouldn't be what health insurance is for. So this brings us to what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the hour. I guess we have about another segment and a half. Last week, the Docs for Patient Care Foundation board was privileged and proud to join the Benjamin Rush Foundation, or the Benjamin Rush Institute. I'm sorry, the Benjamin Rush Institute. And their president has been Beth Haynes has been a guest of Hal in the past, and we joined forces at the Heritage Foundation in Washington D.C. last week to spend a day educating medical students who are members of the institute on healthcare matters, policy matters, and the purpose of Benjamin Rush is a noble and very important thing, which is to provide a counterpoint to what medical students get exposed to in medical school and then residency to follow, which is that most of the academicians who support, you know, big government, single payer health system, you know, that kind of propaganda, and they need a counterpoint to say, no, this is not the only way to think, and give them a choice, give them a chance to hear both points of view and be given an opportunity to integrate what they hear on both sides of the argument. We don't expect them to blindly accept what we say any more than we expect them to blindly accept what their academician professors and attendings are saying. But you know, we want them to have a choice. We were privileged to team up with the Benjamin Rush Institute in D.C. last week. We also made a couple of visits to Capitol Hill, which were very good. One of the highlights of that visit for me was actually listening to a talk over lunch by an author named David Goldhill. Now, who is David Goldhill? He's actually the CEO of the Game Show Network. Now, before you think I've lost my mind and I'm going to start talking about game shows on the Doctor's Lounge, let me go on to the subject of his book. And we mentioned it a little earlier. And for those of you watching the web feed, I'm holding it up. Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And this book does a great job of sort of synthesizing and assembling all of the bits and pieces that we talk about into sort of a cohesive fund of knowledge. And in the introduction of the book, you know, he talks about a couple of bad experiences that he had with medicine, one involving his father and one involving his son. His son got appendicitis and needed an appendectomy, of course, but although the doctors and nurses and the people who actually touched his son were great, the institution was horrible. Right? It took 6 hours or 7 hours to get his son to the operating room for an appendectomy, and during that time he's in horrible pain. They ordered pain medicine. It took an hour for his son to get pain medicine from a pharmacy that was 50 feet away. Right, and I'm kind of reading straight from the book now. This is the rest of the show is going to be sort of a pulling stuff from the book here. But he posed the question: how can the providers be so good, and the institutions in which providers have to work be so bad? And that's really the question. That's really the very nice brings the contrast into sharp focus. His answer is what we've been talking about all along. It's a third-party payment system where the patient is not the customer. The true customer is what Mr. Goldhill, David Goldhill, calls surrogates, and that's a great name for it. These are people who supposedly work on our behalf as patients, and supposedly they do a much better job than individual patients can, but the bulk of the book, I think, is devoted to blowing up that notion and saying, no, individual patients making individual choices, it works in the rest of the economy. Why can't it work in healthcare? I think we're getting to the end of the third segment. We will spend the rest of the show on this when we come back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Don't go away.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Hi, I'm Ray Bowman, hoping you'll join us each Friday at noon for our new show, Food and Farm, brought to you by FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks for sticking around for the fourth segment. We still have lots of good stuff to talk about. The Doctor's Lounge is growing. Our radio show, it now has three times the podcast downloads in the month of March than our average for our first 6 months. So thank you, the listeners, for giving us your time and attention. Thank you for downloading podcasts. Please keep up the good work, and we'll try to keep up the deal on our end and give you stuff that's actually worth listening to. So thanks again very much. We are talking about, in the fourth segment, this book, for those of you on the web feed who can see me, called Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Thought We Knew About Healthcare Is Wrong, by David Goldhill, whom I had the privilege of meeting briefly in Washington, D.C. I hope to get him as a guest on the show in a couple of weeks or maybe a month. But this book takes all the little pieces, all the little arguments that we use to try and support the idea of the free market in healthcare, and kind of assembles them into a comprehensive body of knowledge. And in doing so, does some really great stuff, basically refuting the notion that insurers, the government, all these, you know, surrogate consumers can somehow do a better job of shopping for healthcare and keeping costs down than patients do. And reading some of this book made me think about a famous quote from a former chief executive officer at one of the more prominent Atlanta hospitals. A couple of years after he took the CEO position, he said, you know, he says, when I took this job as a CEO, I thought there was only three things that I had to do. I had to keep patients happy, I had to keep doctors happy, and I had to keep insurers happy. He thought those are the only three things I need to do. After a couple of years in the job, turns out I was wrong. I only really had to do one thing, keep the insurers happy. I didn't have to keep anybody else happy. So interestingly, the surrogate model took doctors and patients out of the equation. And that, you know, under the pressures that this particular CEO was under, there was really only one thing he had to do, which was deal with what Mr. Goldhill calls the surrogates, right? Medicare, Medicaid, private insurers, who stand in our place as the consumer of healthcare, while we stand as patients, as the recipient of the service. So think about all the arguments that big government people make about why it is that we need insurance, that we as individual consumers in the healthcare marketplace are helpless, right? Patients aren't smart enough to understand the intricacies of healthcare, all of the science and biology and physiology behind health and disease. Patients have no ability to discriminate between what's an appropriate treatment and what's an inappropriate treatment, especially under the stress of a severe illness, right? If somebody's in the ER with a heart attack, they're not going to shop around. If they're in there with a stroke, they can't shop around. Time is of the essence. They're too desperate. Individuals can't negotiate prices. Only large insurers that represent lots of people can get, you know, volume discounts, high quantity pricing. And it turns out Mr. Goldhill does a great job of debunking all of these. So you think about some of these. You know, patients aren't smart enough to understand healthcare. Well, it's no different in any other sector of the economy, right? I got my laptop, I got my tablet right here. Even though I'm an IT guy, I don't know how this thing works. I don't know what chips go where. I don't know anything about the deep programming behind Windows 8 or, you know, how an Intel CPU runs. I don't know any of that stuff. I don't understand the materials that are in it. I only know what the results are, and I know what people said about this particular laptop before I bought it. But in healthcare, that's really no different, and especially now with the internet and patients' ability to research what they're doing. I mean, most of the patients in my North Atlanta market have already researched their thyroid problem, their allergies, whatever, before they come and see me. And so they're, you know, quite well informed. So the idea that patients aren't smart enough as a group to research their choices makes absolutely no sense. And David makes the argument beautifully in the book. You know, then we have this concept that sick people are always desperate, that, you know, we need insurance because if you're in the ER with a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, one of these God forbid catastrophic events, you're not going to shop around. You have to get care from the doctor that's there at your bedside. And that may be true for that small percentage of patients that actually face that problem. But the truth is, as David says in the book, that the vast majority of healthcare is not delivered under those conditions. Right? If a patient is going to get referred by an endocrinologist to a head and neck surgeon for a thyroid nodule, right, one of the most common situations that I face in the office, they have plenty of time. They can go to me. They can go to the guy across the street. They can go to a big academic medical center. They have lots of choices, and they have time to make those choices. Chronic disease, management of diabetes, hypertension, all of the things that generate huge amounts of cost in healthcare are not made under duress at 2 o'clock in the morning. They're made under calm conditions at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So the idea that we need a large insurer to stand in our place makes no sense from the medical desperation standpoint. It makes no sense from the informed shopper standpoint. And the bottom line that David makes in the book is that, you know, as individual consumers, as a disconnected, poorly coordinated mass of individuals, that actually that model works just fine. All right. When I walk into Best Buy, I'm theoretically powerless against Sony or Samsung or, you know, whoever else, Vizio, whoever else is building TVs. And yet, not only am I able to wait for a sale or negotiate price, but it turns out that in a free market economy, they come to me. Right? I get emails from Best Buy advertising sales on television, sales on computers. Why don't we have that in healthcare? Right? MRI technology has been around for 20, 30 years. Why isn't there a low-cost leader in MRI? Why isn't there a luxury, you know, we'll pamper you for your MRI segment? Why isn't there a safety segment? You know, all these things that say happen in the car market, where everybody's got a little niche, right? There's the inexpensive segment, the safety-minded segment, the nerdy segment, the luxury segment, the performance segment, right? I can advertise my MRI goes from 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds. Maybe it means I can get your study done in 4.5 minutes and get you home sooner. Why isn't all that out there? Because there is no incentive for healthcare providers, whether they're radiologists or primary doctors or whoever, to advertise to us consumers because we're not their customers. Right? Their relationship is a closed-door relationship with the insurers, and so none of that free market pressure on pricing works. And let's look at a couple of examples within the field of medicine. Right, let's look at LASIK surgery. And again, this is from the book, Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Know About Healthcare is Wrong by David Goldhill. It's in the book, and excuse me, again, it's the idea of consumer pressure driving prices down. Where was LASIK 20 years ago? Right, laser surgery to fix your nearsightedness, that kind of thing. Well, it was about $5,000 per eye when it first came out. It was fiendishly expensive. What's happened in the ensuing 20 years? Well, that cost has dropped significantly. And you can find, you know, advertisements for LASIK less than $500 per eye. So the cost has gone down by, you know, depending on your statistics, anywhere from 75 to 90% a drop. You know, just like computers do, just like cars do, just like cell phone use. The free market has driven those prices down because LASIK's not covered by insurance. Right, ophthalmologists that do LASIK surgery must market to consumers. They either are gonna make their niche on price or quality or the technological advanced nature. They have all the latest and greatest equipment. Yeah, maybe you'll pay a little more with us, but it's worth it. We don't have any of that in mainstream healthcare. And so Gold Hill makes a great argument for a model that puts that divides the healthcare system into two pieces. That part which is routine stuff, that is non-urgent things that should be in the private marketplace with minimal and no involvement by a surrogate, as he called it, basically Medicare, Medicaid, or insurers. And then you have a second tier or level, I should say, that is covered by insurance. And again, you know, just like I was telling you about these Florida legislatures who are Democrats, it turns out that Mr. Goldhill is a self-described liberal Democrat. And in the book, he starts to make the argument for national health insurance, believe it or not, but not national health insurance the way most liberals talk about it, the way Ted Kennedy used to talk about it, which is cradle to grave, every checkup, you know, every vaccine, every piece of routine care. He's saying, no, and this is a quote from the book, insuring everyone is not the same as insuring everything. So it may be a very broad insurance plan in terms of the people it covers, but it's a very narrow insurance plan in terms of the items it covers. So tie this back to what we saw in these Florida legislatures in committee. We have Democrats talking about very conservative ideas, right? The legislatures are supporting, in Florida, supporting this plan pushed forward by our president, Dr. Gross. And we have a self-described liberal author talking about a plan which would sharply cut back those parts of the healthcare system that are covered by insurance. So this is huge. And again, it makes me wonder, you know, you see little things here and there, the Florida legislature, this noteworthy author, you know, the things that are going on with mobile technology and health information technology that's promoting, you know, a pure, unfettered consumer choice model. And you wonder, or at least you hope, that maybe this giant aircraft carrier of a bloated healthcare system is beginning to change course just a little bit. And maybe if we measure in terms of years and even decades, maybe the pendulum is going to start swinging back. So we have a couple of minutes left. I'm just going to talk about some of the things that Mr. Goldhill talks about in his book, some of the myths, some of the things that we accept as true in the healthcare system that really isn't. So the first thing he's talking about is cost versus price. So think about this. He opens that little piece of the book with some good statistics from 2008. So think about this for a minute. In 2008, in the early part of 2008, gas prices went from $3 a gallon to $4 a gallon. And there was all kind of fussing going on about that and all kind of talking heads talking about that and all kind of fuss. It turns out that when you raise the price of gas from $3 a gallon to $4 a gallon, you cost an average family of four about $1,200 a year in gasoline. In the same time period, healthcare costs went up for that same family of four by about the same amount of money, $1,100. You know, give or take, you know, given the uncertainties of those sorts of measurements, basically the same amount of money. Did you see that kind of fuss about healthcare costs going up? No, you didn't see that. Yeah, a couple of news headlines. Yeah, it's going up, sure. But when you address something as a cost instead of a price, you imply through language, and again, for the politicians and the bureaucrats, that's no accident. You imply through language there's nothing you can do about it. That a cost is something, it is what it is, you pay it, and you go on. And that's not true. It's not a cost, it's a price. And it can be changed if you change the model. We're about out of time. Thank you very much for listening for the hour. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Gotta go, it's allergy season, the office is full. See ya.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.